This is The Book in the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
In the Bible, Shiloh is the site where the Israelites under Joshua located the tabernacle after the Exodus, and where it was the worship center for 300 years. In our previous episode, Scott Stripling reported on the 2023 excavation season at Tel Shiloh. Scott is the provost of the Biblical Seminary in Katy, Texas, the president of the Near East Archaeological Society, and the director of excavations for Associates for Biblical Research at Tel Shiloh. We continue the conversation with a discussion of the history of Shiloh.
Well, the name Shiloh is probably a cousin of Shalom. So Shiloh meaning something like tranquility. Why Joshua chose Shiloh to erect the tabernacle, we don't know. It was in his tribal allotment of Ephraim, and it was centrally located. Perhaps if the people of Shiloh were confederated with the people of Shechem in a city-state alliance, then that also makes sense, because we know there's a clear alliance, looking at the Amarna letters and the biblical text, with Shechem and the patriarchs, and then, you know, once they return into the land. Shiloh itself is an amazing site. It's about 5 acres inside this walled enclosure.
Well, if there is a connection to the Amarna letters and the site Silu that's mentioned in the Amarna letters, it almost seems as if that was a place where the Israelites, as they came into the land, connected with maybe a friendly population that was welcoming them.
Yeah, that's really what it seems like, because there's no mention in the biblical text of resistance. And in the Amarna letter in 288, it's talking about, and Turbasu was slain in the gate of Silu. And it seems that this Turbasu is an Egyptian governor of the site, mayor, governor, whatever you want to call them. And the people of Shiloh rise up against him and overthrow him, and he's slain in the gate there. So yeah, they don't have any love for Egypt at Shiloh, and you can see why the Israelites would find a commonality there.
And then there's a connection with Shechem that you mentioned. This is the area of Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, which kind of became a worship center as it's depicted in the Judges.
That's exactly right. There's definitely a sympathy to monotheism or Yahwehism, if you will, in that Ephraim Manassim territory. That's kind of the epicenter of the emergence of the Israelite nation.
Well, mentioning Mount Ebal and maybe jumping to another topic, the curse tablet that your team found as you excavated the dump of an earlier excavation has been in the news now for a year and a half. You have published the inscription on the inside of that tablet that was detected by computer tomography. It's raised some controversy. Is there anything new related to the Mount Ebal curse tablet?
Well, yes, we continue to research now the outside of the tablet. We're going to sometime this winter make a trip over there and do a further examination of the outside as we prepare for a publication of that. And it's been interesting to see sort of the firestorm, if I can use that term, of controversy. You look back at, for example, the publication of the Caiapha Ostracon, and you have the same sort of idea. When epigraphers start looking at ancient inscriptions, you know, they're all over the map. And I knew that that would be the case. I said that at our press conference initially. I know there's going to be a lot of different ways of reading this, because there's not a standardization of the text. What did surprise me was that some epigraphers went so far as to say that they didn't see any letters at all on there. I understand this. This is challenging, because we're not talking about seeing it. They've never seen a text before in a negative image through tomography. And it took us a long time to learn to see through the scans as well. But what we thought we were seeing as proto-alphabetic letters, we then got reinforcement when we studied the outside, and we have bulges on the outside that reinforce what we're seeing on the inside. And so I'm very confident that these are proto-alphabetic letters, as were our epigraphers, as were the renowned list of scholars in the article that had reviewed it, as were the peer reviewers for Heritage Science. To say that now people are going to battle it out for a while, that's to be expected.
You have bulges on the outside, and it sounds like there's also lettering on the outside that you're trying to discern?
There's definitely lettering on the outside. The very first time I looked at the tablet, I could see lettering. It was clearly glyptic, clearly intentional. At that point, I didn't know what it was, but I knew it wasn't Greco-Roman. And so I was just puzzling with what exactly this is. But with the naked eye on the outside, you can clearly see an Aleph, you can clearly see a Resh and other letters. And then in magnification, of course, you can see a lot more than that. And so I think we're going to find on the outside similar to what we found on the inside. It will probably be similarly controversial because we don't know whether the letters are right or left or boustrophedon and so forth. But we're confident that the name Yahweh is on there. If we're right, then this is the earliest mention of the name of the Hebrew God, and it comes from a place where the Bible says that there was worship to God, and it's on a curse tablet. I kind of like to go from the known to the unknown. And so, what do we know? Well, we know it's a defixio. We know it's a curse tablet because we've seen hundreds of these. We know there's writing on it. There's no such thing as a curse tablet that doesn't have writing. So, to say there's not writing on the inside of it is laughable. There's no point of having a defixio if there's not writing on it. We know that that writing is very ancient, that it's proto-alphabetic. We think that we have the name Yahweh, and we think we have a series of curses on there. That's kind of where we stand in our research right now.
So it's the actual content of the writing and the dating also that's controversial.
That's right. Now, the dating is, of course, reinforced by the archaeological context. There's only two choices at Mount Ebal. There's Late Bronze II, as early as 1400, and there is Iron Age I. Those are your only options. We also have the style of the writing. We also have the source of the lead from a mine in Lavrion. All archaeologists agree on a few things, and one of them is that the Late Bronze Age civilization collapsed around 1200, and exports from the Aegean to Canaan ceased around that time. So these factors altogether strongly suggest a pre-1200 date. And quite frankly, that's why there's a lot of pushback, because that's very problematic for those who are holding to a paradigm that Israelites don't emerge until a later time. If you're dealing with archaeological evidence that suggests that the biblical dating is correct, believe me, my friend, you're going to get a whole lot more pushback. It's not just all academic.
For those who've just joined us, we're talking with Scott Stripling, the Director of Excavations for the Associates for Biblical Research at Tel Shiloh. And in addition to talking about excavations at Tel Shiloh, there's this curse tablet that was excavated at the dump site from the earlier excavation at Mount Ebal. So it sounds like as you tried to figure out what to do with this curse tablet, you concentrated first on trying to figure out what the inscription was on the inside rather than the outside. And that was just because you knew that this computer tomography way of investigating documents was available to you then. That's why you started with the inside inscription.
I really didn't know, other than what I could see with my eyes. I knew there were some glyptic markings on the outside, but normally the inscriptions on these things are on the inside. That's the point of sealing them. And then they become binding and they can't be opened because they're brittle and they'll fall apart. So that curse then becomes binding at that point. Looking back, had I known that we did have as much text on the outside as we now think we have, I would have started with that because people would have been looking at what they're actually seeing with their eyes and not having to deal with the tomography. We pursued that, assuming that that's where the primary text was. When we found text there, of course, we felt the obligation to publish that. You know, that's what you do with an inscription. You publish and you say, to the best of our ability, having done all the research, and listen, Heritage Science is ranked in the 93rd percentile of academic journals. It is a highly rated journal. When they publish something, it's saying, this is serious, this is plausible, and here's the data in a clear, clean way so that then other scholars can study it. So I felt that that was our responsibility, was to say what we thought it said and then to give the data to others. We will be releasing a website. You know, these things always take longer than we wish that they did, but we will put out a website that has more raw data that scholars will be able to then for themselves do more things with it.
When do you expect to be able to release a reading on what's on the outside of the tablet then? How long do you think it will take?
Well, I don't want to paint myself into a corner on this because I want to take my time. Obviously, whatever we think it says, then it's going to be under the microscope, so to speak. So I would like to say that by this time next year that we'll have something out on the outer part, but we're not going to rush it.
We talked about the excavation of Tel Shiloh. We've talked about the Mount Ebal tablet. You've spent a good chunk of time in Israel this summer. What else is going on that is interesting and important to you in biblical archaeology right now?
Well, I tell you, I love to follow what's happening at the other dig sites. I think I'd be a great correspondent because I'm so interested in what others are finding and how it gives us this meta narrative of what was happening in antiquity. I've been following the Tel Bernah excavations. They're coming close now to wrapping it up, either their final season or maybe one more after this. Late Bronze Age II site in the Shephelah. I'm interested in the work at the Ophel as they continue to expose things from the period of Solomon and right by the Temple Mount. And of course, Garfinkel is now heading that work. The excavations at Azika, led by Oded Lipschitz and Tel Aviv University, are on my radar. Hazor, you have now the transition from with Ben-Tor finally stepping down now in his late 80s. Sort of the torch has been passed there, and you've got both Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University doing separate digs at that important site. The Tower of David in Jerusalem just reopened after 8 years, and I was able to attend the grand opening while I was there with Orna, who was the conservator there, and so got the ultimate tour of that. From Herodium to the Tower of David, Hazor in the north, a lot is happening.
The Tower of David Museum has always been a place that I've enjoyed visiting because, in a very wonderful, interesting way, it tells the story of the history of Jerusalem, which is, one of the most important cities in Christianity and Judaism. And now they've completely redone it and updated everything, and it's even a more modern museum and probably tells the story even better. I haven't had a chance to see it yet.
Yeah. Oh, you've got to. There's a new model there, an old new model where the Turks over 150 years ago commissioned a model of Jerusalem to be built when they were in charge. That got sent to Switzerland to be on display and ended up in a basement in Switzerland for, over a century. Recently returned to Israel, and Orna restored it, and it's now on display there. The reason it's amazing is you can see what Jerusalem looked like 150 years ago. And it's very detailed and very accurate. Look at where the city of David is. The claims that, well, there were already people living there. And, for example, there were Palestinians who were living in the city of David at that time. Not according to the Turks, there weren't, because it's totally vacant. Just lots of little things I think people enjoy visiting that model in the Tower of David.
Well, it's always a delight to talk with you, Scott. Thank you for taking the time out to be with us once again. Scott Stripling is the president of the Near East Archaeological Society, provost of the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas, and director of excavations for Associates for Biblical Research at Tel Shiloh. We'd like to remind our listeners that one of the best ways to keep up to date on biblical archaeology is through our Biblical Archaeology News Magazine, Artifacts. You can find out how to subscribe at radioscribe.com. We also have information on the next time we'll be traveling to Israel in November of 2024, and we invite you to join us. Information at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book in the Spade.
The Book in the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.